You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome my next guest on the show. It's Dr. Sean Palmer, amongst many claims to fame. He is the head of or chair of Monarchy New Zealand. He's a man who's done his doctorate here in New Zealand because he's actually Canadian originally, but now a New Zealand citizen. He did his doctorate in the nature of the Crown and the Commonwealth. But amongst others, I don't know if it's a claim to fame, Sean, but you were also my best man at my wedding.
It was quite an experience.
But unfortunately, listeners, we're not going to be discussing my wedding today, as we have touched on a bit earlier. With King's birthday having just happened, I wanted to actually keep, if you will, that royal flavour going, and sort of the jokes or the light elements aside, I wanted to bring Sean on to talk about why the monarchy is important in the modern day. And again, to declare my hand, I've known Sean for a long, long time, and I've also been involved with Monarchy New Zealand. So I'm a staunch monarchist. Some of you might be going, oh no. But we're hoping over the course of the next few minutes to sort of explain, I think, why both of us, Sean, see the value in the monarchy in New Zealand. And we're going to come from it from a constitutional monarchy side rather than a royalist side. And Sean will touch on it. But Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, well, firstly, what did you do for King's birthday?
I took the day off, the whole day, the whole thing. I said, I'm not coming into work. And they were all fine with that.
Did Charles have any say on that?
No, I don't think he got the day off.
No, that would probably be true, actually. No, again, I don't. So as you can see, we get on quite well. So we hope this will be, and it should be, a serious chat. But no, I actually just took the day off as well. It was a chance to relax with family, get some gardening done. But, you know, King's birthday is an important part of our calendar because it recognises an important part of our system. But I think before we get into it, it would probably be good for listeners to understand a little bit about yourself and why you are actually an expert. You are an expert in this country, I would argue, one of the very few experts on the nature of constitutional monarchy. So let's let listeners know a little bit about you.
Oh, well, as you mentioned, I'm originally from Canada, but I came to New Zealand quite some time ago to do a master's, and I enjoyed it so much. I stayed and did a PhD. They were both on the role of the monarchy in modern democracies. And I have been ever more convinced through those studies and through events that have unfolded in the past many years of what an extraordinary system it is. It is really, when we get right down to it, it is the very best system of government ever tested anywhere in the history of the world. That is the simplest way that I can put the value of the monarchy. And I suspect over the next little while, we'll probably drill into what makes it the best in the history of the world.
Well, that's a bold claim. It's a bold claim, and I know some listeners will be going, oh, yeah, okay. So I encourage, tune in, guys, keep listening. We'll tease some of this out. And obviously, you can always get in touch with me and through me to Sean through inbox at realitycheck.radio, or, of course, you can text at 2057. Let us know what you think. But let's start then with the basics, Sean. I mean, you've done your studies over many, many years about the nature of the monarchy, and when, in particular, we're talking about the constitutional monarchy. And I mentioned just a few moments ago, there's a difference between being, if you will, a constitutional monarchist and a royalist. Mm-hmm. Would you want to just quickly explain that to people?
Well, I think there are a lot of different reasons that people support the institution of the monarchy. And, you know, they all have their merits, these different reasons. Some of them may be that they like the celebrity aspects of members of the royal family. That's where I would tend to lean towards. That's a sort of royalist perspective. What are they wearing? What are they doing? Who are they feuding with? The stuff that
tends to make with Harry and Meghan, like that.
Everybody's. I think everybody's doing that. You know, it's the sort of stuff that gets into the tabloids and in the newspapers. From my perspective, you know, there are other angles to consider. You know, there's the pageantry and the pomp and ceremony, which, let's face it, the monarchy does very, very well. And that's got a lot of value in it. There's the history, there's the culture. Many people look at it and say, oh, well, my family came from there originally, and I like to have the connection. And that's a fine reason. I'm not going to dispute anyone's reasons for supporting the monarchy. But for me, the most important reason, and the one that I'm most interested in, is the role of the monarchy in our constitution, our structure of government, and the role that it plays particularly in the defense of democracy, because that's an angle that's not seen very often. For every tabloid headline, for every 100 tabloid headlines, there might be an article that talks once about the value of the monarchy to democracy. You know, it's just not covered very much, partly because I think people don't think it's very interesting. Constitutions, that tends to put some people to sleep, but it's an incredibly important part of our society. And in many ways, we're lucky we don't have to think about it. There are multitudes of countries around the world where people do worry about their country, the stability of their government, their constitution every day. And we don't ever have to do that. And so it's very easy to overlook how wonderful the system is that we have. And, you know, some people ask me, what's the point of the king's birthday? Why have a holiday for that? I say, if nothing else, it gives us one brief moment to go, oh yeah, we are a monarchy. And we've got a pretty great constitution and country. And those things are interconnected.
I think we might tease a bit of that out. I mean, for all the Republican sentiments and people, particularly in New Zealand, I suspect the same in Canada and Australia, we'll poo-poo the monarchy and make light of it. But I'm always struck, actually, with King's Birthday. Of course, it used to be Queen's Birthday. Since mm-hmm. Queen Elizabeth passed away, we've had the name change, and listeners will be familiar too. We no longer have Queen's Councils, we have King's Councils. But King's Birthday, people get into the swing of it. You go through all the shops and they've got pictures of Charles and crowns, and I think we secretly like it. And maybe the other more serious point is the monarchy, that the system of monarchy is actually deeply ingrained into New Zealand. But I think your key point that you were trying to get to, the holiday aside, is this is an important part of our democratic structure. And I think we should tease that out a little bit more for listeners. But I really liked your point that we don't wake up in the morning worrying about our democracy. And, you know, if people have followed me over the years, you'd have heard some of my speeches where I think New Zealanders take a lot of this for granted. Our democracy, our electoral system, our freedom and rights, we certainly have taken those for granted. We wake up in the morning not worried. And part of it, I think we have to stress, the monarchy is part of it. So, yeah, tease that out for listeners. Why is the monarchy helping our democracy?
It helps in a raft of different ways. I suppose we can start by keeping in mind that it is really the foundation on which the Constitution was built. It is the system of government that we inherited from our ancestors. Everything in terms of political power revolves around the monarchy. You know, the actions that are taken by the government of the day are given effect. They're given authority by the king and or his governor general here in New Zealand. You know, any law that's passed, sure, it passes the legislature. It's not a law until it's signed. That signature is not a rubber stamp. It's not simply guaranteed. There have been questions raised by governors general in the past about various laws. We know that monarchs have occasionally asked our prime ministers and elected officials you know, are you sure this is what you're wanting? Is this the correct direction to go? Of course, I'll support it if you believe it is. But there is that little bit of a check.
Well, it's not a veto, is it? It's not like the presidential system that you might see in America.
Exactly. It's not a veto. A veto is very much a sort of sledgehammer. It really grinds everything to a halt. And our system of government, I think, assumes goodwill of our elected officials and says, right, well, we will guarantee to you the power that you need to govern the country as long as you stay within what we would consider the constitutional norms. You know, what stops a prime minister from simply saying, I'm going to pass a law which says we no longer need any elections? You know, some countries around the world say, well, the courts will stop him. And the response I would have to that is that the courts don't have any tanks. So a court can issue whatever statement it wants, but if it were really to come down to a difficult situation, you do need that final executive authority, and that is what is held in reserve by the monarch and the governor general. It isn't handed to the prime minister or the cabinet to do as they wish.
So in many ways, I mean, I get this all the time when I'm out and about. You know, there's people saying to me, certainly when I was in Parliament, that, you know, a government of the day would pass certain legislation and they would be asking that the Governor General or at that time the Queen should stop the bill, should override it. They to me, were acting a bit like an American president. And so that veto power, another force. Ours, from the way you've described it, Sean, is more subtle. The King, or the Queen in the past, but the King today operates with Parliament and with the will of the Parliament. That's why he has ministers. So when we talk about the Minister of Finance or the Minister of Education, they are there to minister or give, if you will, advice to the King. And he works under that advice. So he's not an autocrat. He doesn't have all this enormous power to just wield around at his whim. He does it through his elected government, the Parliament. But you are saying that, you know, if there was a real push comes to shove, he does have a few tools up his sleeve. So one of them, you're saying he can give them advice.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there's a little phrase they use about it, isn't there?
There is, that the monarch is welcome to encourage, to warn, and to be consulted. Those are the sort of rights of a modern democratic monarch. And it is known throughout the countries that the king is king of, that in the past half century, all of those powers have been used by Queen Elizabeth II or her governors general in these different countries, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. But I like what you say about it. It's more subtle than that. It is a much more negotiated arrangement if there's a constitutional crisis. There isn't that sledgehammer that just comes down and vetoes everything. There's much more discussion about it. But, I mean, ultimately, in a democracy, a democratic monarch wants to see the democratic will of the people expressed. So these powers are very rarely used, these reserve powers, but rather like a fire extinguisher. You know, a fire extinguisher hopefully is very rarely used in your kitchen, but that doesn't mean that you're going to throw it out. If you say, well, I haven't had a fire in 20 years in the kitchen, we don't need this fire extinguisher anymore. And that's very much what's happening in our system of government, is that we have an understanding the monarch will assent to laws that have been duly passed by Parliament. But if those laws were to overstep the mark, if they were going to be unconstitutional, if they were going to, you know, undermine democracy in a significant, verifiable way, then it is reasonable to think that possibly even just behind the scenes, there will be a royal or a vice-regal word mentioned to say, you know, are you sure this is the correct direction to go? because it does seem to be rather concerning.
Yeah, and I can say as a former politician, you know, again, I suppose I want to get the again, I'll use that word nuance across to people, and I'll make it as a statement. You don't want a king or a queen making the decisions of what they do not like. Mm. As I say, so many people have come to me, oh, I just wish the Governor General would strike this silly law down. It's like, well, no, you don't want that because, you know, what's the next law they're going to strike down at a whim? Again, it's important to respond to the Parliament. But if some government, God forbid, tried to pass some terribly anti-democratic law, as you said, it's, you know, removing elections, for example, I think the mere threat from a king or a queen to say, actually, I won't sign this, which of course would become public, would become a major scandal. Like, I don't think a government could survive is what I'm trying to say. So the monarch doesn't have to do much, but just the sheer statement, if you will, I'm grasping for words here, the intention to say, hey, this is an overreach, I have to tell the public I won't sign the legislation.
And better than that, not only will it become public, but really the single most important power a modern monarch has is the ability to call an election. Now, our Governor General does it in New Zealand, usually on behalf of the King. And so I lump the Governors General in with the same powers that the monarch has. Usually an election is called at the request of the Prime Minister on the date of the Prime Minister's choosing. But again, if something terribly undemocratic was happening, something really, really problematic, it's perfectly reasonable to think that the Governor General or the monarch might say, well, hang on a minute now, this is very controversial, this is potentially dangerous, this is possibly anti-democratic, why don't we put this issue to the people? Let's have an election 6 weeks from now, right? Let's dissolve Parliament, let's have an election, and you can bet that whatever this issue was, that will be front and center at that election. There would be no hiding it, there would be, you know, no way. It would essentially be a referendum on that idea. And if that idea were to pass, you know, if the government were to be reelected on the policy of instituting this position, there would be really very little that anyone could do to fault the system. You know, the monarch would say, all right, it has gone to the people. The people have chosen this. This is the way they want to go. The monarch does not have dictatorial autocratic powers. They will follow the democratic requests of the people. So, I mean, really, when we get right down to it, that is probably the single most important power that a constitutional monarch has, is just an emergency election if one is needed. And very few systems outside of constitutional monarchy have the capacity to do that.
And I think it's obviously taken us a few minutes to get to this. As you can see, or not see, listeners, as you can hear, of course, it's like peeling an onion. This is actually quite a, not only a delicate, but actually it's a paradoxical. It's quite a modern institution, I'd argue, but of course has an enormous history. There is a delicateness to it with anything in democracy, but it's also quite robust, but there's many, many layers to it. But I would argue too, none of this is really theoretical. And we might just look to a couple of overseas examples to illustrate that to people. So, you know, Sean's fundamental point is if there was one key factor which makes a king or queen important, is that they can call elections. But as he also noted, and as I've noted to listeners, I'm generally in agreement because I'm a monarchist, a constitutional monarchist as well. They do act at the will of the people. And again, I just keep coming back to that because I know many listeners have often put to me in the past, why did the Governor General not step in on this circumstance? Or why did the King or Queen not act and stop these things happening? That the bar for that to happen is so, so high. It's not disagreeing with government policy. That's not where we want to end up. It is so, so high. And you talked about calling elections. In many ways, that was the Australian context a few years ago. Some of you who were around in the the 70s with Kerr and
Whitlam. Yes, absolutely. You know, there was a very good example, and it has been fudged in history and in the retelling. It has been given an awful lot of spin, particularly because one participant lived for many, many years afterwards and the other died quite young. And so, you know, his perspective, the Governor General's perspective, really did not get all that much attention. So the Kerr Whitlam affair in Australia in what 1975
was it Gough Whitlam? Did I get it wrong with Kerr?
No. It was Gough Whitlam was the Prime Minister,
and that's why I'm mixing it up.
So so the Gough Whitlam affair in 1975 in Australia is a very good example of where a Prime Minister began to demonstrate what we would consider perhaps undemocratic tendencies, perhaps a cavalier attitude towards Parliament. Maybe that's the best way to describe it is, you know, the Australian Parliament has two chambers that are both elected, the House of Representatives and the Senate. The Prime Minister is drawn from the House of Reps, and he had a majority there. And he was trying to pass a budget in 1975, which is a critical test of any government. You must be able to pass a budget. If you do not have the support required to pass a budget, then your claim to the title of Prime Minister is very tenuous at best. He tried for many, many months to pass a budget. He got it through the House, which he controlled, but he couldn't get it through the Senate, which he didn't control. And for months, this dragged on. The Prime Minister was unable to spend money. And while that might have been great for Australia's bank account, the problem is, you know, you're essentially going bankrupt sitting on a pile of money. The tax money is there, but you can't spend it because it's all spent through the budget. So who's paying the police? Who's paying the military? Who's paying the teachers? Who's paying the doctors? You know, any publicly funded office, you know, this all has to come through the budget. So anyway, for months and months, this drags on, and he refuses to negotiate with the Senate. And eventually, as they were coming up to the Christmas break, it was about the middle of November, and in Australia, as is quite common here, the House rises before Christmas and doesn't come back for quite some time. And this would mean that this protracted dispute would have kept going. And the Governor General felt that something had to be done here. And he again spoke to the Prime Minister and said, will you negotiate with the party that controls the Senate? Will you pass this budget? There has to be some expenditure put forward. And the Prime Minister, who from the sounds of it was a rather pig-headed gentleman, said, I will not. I am the Prime Minister. I control the lower house. It is not for me to bend to the Senate's will. They will bend to mine, which again doesn't sound terribly democratic, or at the very least, not very realistic. Anyway, the Governor General felt that this had gone on too long and fired the Prime Minister on the spot. He said, you know, I'm sorry that that's your position. I will have to determine your commission. And you are no longer Prime Minister. And it is reputed that Whitlam said, I will call the palace. And the Governor General said, well, you may try, but it is not common for the Queen to take the calls of former Prime Ministers, which, you know, made that all the more clear as to what had happened to Whitlam. Anyway, immediately following that, the Governor General brought the Leader of the Opposition from the House of Representatives in, and it was his party that controlled the Senate. And he said to the Leader of the Opposition, I will make you Prime Minister now on two conditions. The first is that you pass Whitlam's budget exactly as it is. It has gone through the House, so that part's finished. You must now let that budget go through the Senate so that it is his budget, that he was prime minister. It is his budget that goes through. That's the first thing. And the second requirement is that I require you to request an election of me immediately so that we pass that budget, we solve the financial crisis, and then we will immediately have an election and we will let the people decide what's going on. And the leader of the opposition said yes and became the prime minister for what I gather was a couple of hours. The budget was passed. The election was called. It was at that time that former Prime Minister Whitlam considered this a royal coup. He said, this is outrageous. This is a royal coup. Well, I have to say, when you look at it, that's really incredibly disingenuous. It is really offensive to anyone who has ever lived through an actual coup.
But I think that's that's sort of the fundamental point throughout this. I mean, firstly, it's actually quite again, for slightly older listeners, you'll be familiar with this Australian case. It's often quoted, but I think often misrepresented. And I think first and foremost, Sean, you've given a good history on it. But the second, which is the reason we started this, is ultimately this was no coup. This was no takeover by the Queen or her Governor General or at the time the opposition. The only thing that really happened was a new election was called.
And I think that's really the critical element here, is that no coup anywhere in the history of the world has immediately been followed by an election. That, you know, nobody holds a coup for the sake of calling an election. And that is exactly what happened there. It was interesting. The Australian people backed the decision and returned the former leader of the opposition back into the prime ministership, and the country went on. But they pilloried the governor general in the years to come. As an experienced politician, Whitlam took every opportunity there to belittle the situation. But it was an example of that fire extinguisher. You know, there was a fire breaking out, and the Governor General said, right, we have to resolve this in the most democratic way we can. We didn't hijack the budget. We didn't change the budget. His budget went through, and then there was an election. That's really a triumph of democracy. Far from a failing, that was a triumph of democracy.
I suppose that's the core argument, isn't it? That, you know, and look, there'll be different views out there, but the core argument here is that this monarchical part of our democratic structure allowed this to happen in a way that actually resolved itself. I suppose there's a couple of other points that we should touch on. And one is, this is ultimately a real person. So in other countries that don't have a monarch or a sovereign or a king or queen, you can alternate the language, they have presidents or whatever, or they have constitutions, they have oaths to flags and all sorts of concepts. In the likes of New Zealand, we have a real person.
Absolutely.
And so I suppose, one, just to tease that as an idea, but secondly, to give, again, a real life. Actually, let's start with the real life example, but it might illustrate what I'm saying, because, again, people in America pledge fidelity to the Constitution. Well, that's lovely, but it's a piece of paper. And to be slightly facetious, a piece of paper is not going to turn up in court number one tomorrow. But when you have a king or a queen, they're a real, living, breathing person. And a really good example of this comes out of Spain, where there was a military coup years ago. So take us through that. I don't know, by the way, listeners, why we're talking about coups so much, but it's fascinating nonetheless.
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, a coup is the means by which a democracy ceases to be a democracy. And I think how you handle a potential coup or an actual coup determines the success of your government. You know, every country works perfectly well right up until the moment that it doesn't. And, you know, you hit a speed bump on the road And are you going to end up swerving into the ditch, or are you going to recover and continue on happily? You know, the Spanish example is a really interesting one because it illustrates the value of having a real living, breathing person as the sort of central authority in your country. Some people pledge allegiance to a flag, some to a constitution, some to a country, which I don't know, that could be an outline on a map or dirt. I don't know. You know, there are many things that people use as a placeholder for a monarch when they don't have one.
Well, it's being talked, sorry to interrupt, we need to get to the Spanish example, but, you know, in New Zealand, there's talk about generating a constitution and that we'll have allegiance to that instead of the king or to the Treaty of Waitangi or to vague concepts of what it means to be New Zealand. Again, they're not living, breathing, real people, that concept.
And worse yet, they can't speak for themselves, right? All of these things generally have to be interpreted by other people, usually judges, certainly the upper echelons of power. That may not actually be the most democratic way of going about setting up a country. So you look, the Spanish example is a really interesting one. You know, Franco had been in power until, what, 1975 or thereabouts as a dictator. And he handed power over to King Juan Carlos. And I think most people believed that Franco did that because he thought that the king would rule as a dictator following him. And King Juan Carlos stunned everyone by saying, no, I will be a constitutional monarch. We're going to have democracy in this country. And that was incredibly popular. The country grasped it and flourished for several years until Franco's generals and other subordinates came to realize that they had lost all of the power that they had once enjoyed. And they said, you know, maybe we should try to get that back. And so the military launched a coup. It was called the Colonel's Coup. And I think it was about 1981, 82, somewhere in there. They stormed Parliament in Madrid and they took hostages and they tried to control other key infrastructure around the country. As it was progressing, the king made a very, very clever move. He put on his military uniform. He is, of course, the commander of all of the Spanish military, as most monarchs are in their countries. They are the top authority in the military. And he went on television and he said that he was speaking directly to the military. And he said, I know that you are getting conflicting orders. Some people are telling you to do this and other people are telling you to do that. Well, I am at the top of the chain of command. And if you follow my orders, you cannot be accused of wrongdoing because you have followed the orders of the senior most officer. And I am telling you now to put down your weapons and to go back to your barracks. And it is astounding, but that clarity played a critical role in ending that coup. It collapsed very, very quickly after that. Military support at the lower levels evaporated. And it was a big part of why the King of Spain was tremendously popular for decades afterwards, because he spoke out on behalf of democracy. You know, it's all well and good to have democracy written in your constitution, but the constitution can't speak up. Judges could interpret it, but they could be accused of political bias. They could have the, you know, this influence.
So what you're really saying is that there's no ambiguity when you have a king or a queen. And we're talking here, and I think it's really important to stress to people, we're talking within a democratic constitutional system. We're not talking about autocratic kings and queens and sheiks and so forth. This is in a democratic system like our own. And New Zealand, by the way, shares King Charles with 14 other countries. So that's even more particular. But we're talking within the democratic structure, but having a real person removes ambiguity, because just about any other replacement, a treaty, a constitution, a flag, as you say, can't turn up itself. It can't turn in front of the cameras and say, soldiers, go home. But secondly, it's mediated. I really liked that word earlier. Any constitution has to be mediated through some groups of people. And maybe that takes me then to the next part, because we've talked quite a bit around, obviously, the king and queen, like that of Spain, have been a real person. They can speak for themselves. We've talked about how the monarch holds really, you know, multiple powers, but one that's so critical. You talked about it as a fire extinguisher, that is calling elections. But a third point for me is that apolitical, the king. So Charles is not a politician. I say this as an ex-politician. And, you know, more often than not, Sean, when you have debate in New Zealand, there's always a talk about, well, replace the king with a elected New Zealand head of state. And I'm aghast at that, because you're going to end up, I would argue, and by the way, push back if you like, but we're going to end up with another politician. You're going to end up with President Helen Clark or President John Key. We're going to end up with another class of politician, but the king sits above that. Well, I should phrase it a question rather than a statement. Is the king apolitical?
Oh, yeah. No, look, I mean, I think that is a really significant angle to consider. If we are going to let the politicians write a new constitution to govern politicians, you can be very confident of what that document is going to look like. You know, it's kind of a no-brainer. They're not going to work terribly hard to limit their own powers. They're going to happily find positions for their friends and allies. And, you know, this is where you see in a lot of republics around the world, the presidency is just a sinecure, a retirement post for a former political leader. I mean, look, you know, the current president of Ireland was the former president of the Labour Party of Ireland. Now, he seems to have done an excellent job. You know, I wouldn't say I have any particular problems with him. But in terms of representing the nation, of appearing in all senses to be nonpartisan, I don't think somebody who's been the leader of a political party can claim that. You know, that's just not very realistic. So, you know, yes, we could expect to see politicians put into positions of power. I mean, the other aspect is, and we've seen this in Australia when they haggled over what kind of a republic they would like to be, a prime minister who's enacting a new constitution is not interested in creating a new boss for himself. He's not going to say there will be a president over me and he will have all these powers. They're not interested in doing that. They're interested in getting rid of any boss that they have. And in this case, that would be the monarch.
Well, you could end up in a situation too. So this is for those who are interested in electing a head of state. So replacing the king with someone who's elected. Depending on how you do it, you could end up with a situation where you end up arguably with a president, let's say directly elected by the people, gets a higher vote than the prime minister of the day. So who gets to hold the greater sway? I would argue you could end up with confusion in the system and infight. And that's why I said, you know, somewhat tongue-in-cheek earlier, be careful what you wish for, because you'll end up with a National Party-aligned president or a Labour Party-aligned president. And speaking very personally, I just don't think that's a good idea. I mean, I loved being in Parliament. I love being a politician. But I can tell you now, you don't need more. Mm-hmm. You're better off having someone like the king, the sovereign, sitting outside of it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, really, no matter how you slice up the idea of this republic, you know, this ideal model that we'll all be promised, if you allow Parliament to appoint a president, which is how many presidencies are filled, you know it will be their friends. It will be an ex-politician. It will be somebody with great notoriety like that. And they will be expected to just be a pointless rubber stamp. And I really don't see the value in that. You know, I mean, the value of the monarchy is in having that little bit of possible maneuvering room. But that's just if you're going to have it appointed. If you're going to have the president elected, as you've mentioned, it's entirely possible that there will be gridlock, that a president from one party will simply obstruct the government of another party. And if you're not a fan of the parliament that's been elected, you may like a president who blocks that, but the shoe will be on the other foot in a few years. And that's a recipe for us to get nothing done ever.
Well, that's often why, you know, again, over many years in parliament, I've had people come to me and say, oh, look, I just wish we had a president or even a governor general that could just override, I don't like this government policy, to have it overridden. And you've just nailed the point of why it's not a good idea, because the shoe does move. It will be on the other foot. And one day we'll find ourselves going, oh, I love this policy. And yet a president with a different set of views overrides it. It's just not where we want to be. And so I suppose that's one of the key reasons why you want an apolitical head of state. And there's a lot of conventions around that, which sometimes they argue Charles has breached a little bit where he's opining. But, I mean, we're not talking anything particularly substantial. They keep out of politics.
Well, I think you've actually raised a really interesting point there. For a long time, when the king was the Prince of Wales, he did weigh in on issues such as architecture, environmentalism, conservation, many of the issues that are actually quite important to a lot of New Zealanders. But people used this as an argument against him to say, oh, well, you know, the monarch shouldn't ever weigh in on this. Well, Charles was clear that he wouldn't when he was the monarch. And to his credit, in the last nearly 2 years, he has not weighed in on those issues. He did the work that he was passionate about before he was king. But now that he is king, he understands that it is his job to represent all people, regardless of what side of any issue they might be on. You know, he is there to represent the whole country.
We've chatted through a number of topics and look and been incredibly conscious of the time you've given us. I just want to finish on three quick C's, and this is no pun on Charles's name. I want to talk about the charitable side of the monarchy, the celebrity side, for want of a better term, and the cost side. And then I'm going to get you to answer the quiz that I had earlier. So, yeah, just quickly talk us through the monarch or the monarchy and its role in charity and raising funds for people.
Well, you know, see, I mean, this is a really interesting example. When people say, oh, we should just boot the royal family out, we should just get rid of them, I always think of how the royals might interpret that. They might say, oh, this is very sad. This is very embarrassing. We're very hurt. I guess we're leaving. And I'm sure they would feel those things. But by the same token, we would have essentially released from most social obligation some very wealthy people who can now retire to tropical islands somewhere and lie around on a beach all day. And I think that whatever someone's opinion of the monarchy might be, they have to acknowledge that this is an incredibly hardworking family where we see hundreds and hundreds of events undertaken by each of the senior members every year. You know, they do this because they believe it is their responsibility. It is their duty to do this. And they do it out of regard for their country, whether it's the UK or when they're doing it down here in New Zealand or Australia. You know, they do this because they think it's important. And I think we've gotten a really good deal out of that, that people who could have retired to an island somewhere and slept on a beach all day instead slog away most days of the week at charitable events, at good causes, drawing the limelight that they have to worthy concepts. So,
yeah. And they make hundreds of millions of dollars.
Oh, they do. Absolutely. Look, I mean,
Not for themselves.
Absolutely. Just before Charles became king, I think they had said it was something like he had raised that year £250 million, which is what, about half a billion New Zealand dollars, just that year for charitable causes with his charities around the world. And that is an incredible achievement. And that kind of ability is the sort of thing we actually need to be making more use of.
Well, that sort of links us into the second C. So we talk about the charity. So you talk about almost a half a billion dollars. And we have the likes of the Prince's Trust in New Zealand. But you're beginning to get onto the second C now, which is their, I know you don't like this because we've talked about it before, but it's their celebrity, their status, which, well, you've argued before that they are so well known in the world, we should use this, leverage it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when we think about the monarchy, certainly under the previous Queen Elizabeth II, there was always a question of what hat was she wearing? What kind of purse was Kate going to carry? And these sorts of things, none of which I know anything about. I have very little interest in those things. But they are among the most famous people on the planet. And it is, I think, a resource for New Zealand to utilize when we can say our head of state is Charles III. I mean, that's a name known around the world, even over these last 2 years, you know, as he's assumed this new position. We need to make better use of that. You know, wherever he goes, he has the media following him. And this is true of William, and this is true of George. This is true of most members of the working royal family. That's not just for the sake of the tabloids. That has a real practical value. So when members of the royal family come to New Zealand for a tour of the country, the things we put on that tour really matter. They're usually about our arts and culture, our national values like conservation and environmentalism. There are about our industries, the things that we make and do here in New Zealand. And so, yes, we may pay for the king's travel expenses. Never a salary. We do not pay a member of the royal family a single cent from New Zealand. But we will pay their expenses when they're working here, which I think most people would agree is reasonable. But for that small investment, or relatively small investment, we get global coverage in all the major newspapers, on all the major television channels around the world. Because when Charles holds a kiwi, when William at the age of one holds a buzzy bee, these pictures went all over the world and the world asked, what is this? Where, how do we find these things? How do we get there? What can we do?
Well, I know when, I've forgotten what year it was in Parliament. Long and short, there was a parliamentary report that said for every dollar which New Zealand invests in a visit with the royal family, they get at least $10 back. It's, if you will, free coverage. When you've got everyone from the BBC to the New York Times to Vogue following everything they do, and I've escorted or been right behind Charles and Camilla once, the cameras are going the whole time. It's massive advertising.
Mm. And I think actually one of the other angles I just want to touch on there, because there will be some people out there who say, well, we'll stay in the Commonwealth even if we become a republic, and we'll still have the king and queen come visiting. You know, King Charles has been to Germany and to France recently, and they're not even in the Commonwealth. I would just like to point out that when the king travels to countries outside the countries that he is king of, it is at the behest of the British government. So when the monarch goes to Brazil, it is the British government requesting that the monarch go there, and it is pushing a British agenda in Brazil. And that is fundamentally different to what happens when a member of the royal family comes to New Zealand. That is at the request of the New Zealand government, and it is to push not a British agenda or any other agenda around the world. It is to address a New Zealand agenda. If we were to say, well, we'll become a republic, but we'll stay in the Commonwealth. Yes, we might get a visit from them now and then. I think Brazil gets a visit from the royal family once every 30 or 40 years. And you know, Brazil has, what, 100 million people in it. I don't know how many 4 million in New Zealand would get, but it is our way of steering the monarchy, of controlling our monarchy, our king, and our agenda.
I think the other point, too, I'd quickly make, because I am conscious of your time, we need to use the royal family more. So they are our royal family, okay? But he's the king of the UK, but he's also the king of New Zealand, Australia, Canada. We need to use him as the king of New Zealand to actually advertise New Zealand more. So I'm not just saying coming to visit us, but actually promoting New Zealand wool and meats and so forth. So something for the future. Just quickly then, because I said there were three C's around Charles and this king's birth. We talked about his charitable side, that celebrity, how they can use their public presence. But the other thing is cost. Does this cost New Zealand much at all to have a monarchy?
No. And that's another really wonderful thing. You can have the best system of government in the world, and if it costs a fortune, it's not going to last very long. As I mentioned, we do not pay a single cent to any member of the royal family. In fact, even the British really don't pay salaries to members of the royal family. We tend to cover their expenses when they're working for us. So that's actually quite a deal to have the most famous man in the world as our head of state at no cost to us. What we do pay for is his representative here, because obviously he can't be here most of the time. We do pay for a governor general and for government house and those sorts of things. But it is certainly not more expensive than having a president would be. We could assume that the president would move into government house, and so those costs would remain very similar. But we know that as a representative of the king, the governor general does not have quite as high a profile, does not need to push their own personal persona out into the rest of the country or even the world. So my guess is that any change to a republic will almost certainly have to come at an increased cost.
It will, but I mean, they'll ultimately be, so this is now me making a statement, but they'll be ultimately political. Hmm. So they'll need their press secretaries, their spin doctors, they'll be absolutely needing to maintain their presence in some shape or form. Sean, I am incredibly conscious of your time. We have covered a lot today. Look, and particularly to listeners, it's very clear, as I said at the start, Sean and I are aligned on this. It's a king's birthday special, so it's obviously last weekend, but I wanted to bring these themes to you. But I welcome your feedback. There'll be those of you who completely disagree or have other questions, and of course you can always get in touch via email at info@realitycheck.radio or text us at 2057. Let me know what you think. In fact, if you've got particular challenges or questions, or you go, no, I think Dr. Palmer is wrong, well, let us know. In fact, I can bring Sean back on to, discuss those. But as part of today's show, Sean, I was getting a bit tongue-tied there on the S's. I did a bit of a quiz for people at the start, and I thought it'd be great if you could answer them. I'm confident you'll get, we have 11 questions, 10 and then a bonus question, but I'll put them to you to answer for everyone to wrap this session up. How many times, so I hope everyone, by the way, you've got your answers there and you haven't cheated and Googled, but how many times has Charles, as in, well, we used to know him as Prince Charles, now King, how many times has Charles visited New Zealand?
It has been 10 times so far, and I am very confident that there will be a few more in the years to come.
And just as a side note, because obviously I had to do some research, his last trip was down here with Camilla, and they were in Auckland, Waitangi, Christchurch, and Kaikoura. I think that was in 2019. The second question, which royal went to school here in New Zealand?
Well, he was known as Prince Edward at the time, but he is now known as the Duke of Edinburgh, having essentially inherited the title from his father.
And he was at Whanganui Collegiate. How many sovereigns or kings and queens have there been since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi?
Ah, yeah. Well, see, that's always I do enjoy that question. There have actually been seven since then. And I suspect we'll probably talk about them a little bit more as we go down.
And well, can you name them? Who are the seven?
Yeah, I probably could. They would be Victoria, her son Edward VII, his son George V, his son Edward VIII, his brother George VI, and his daughter Elizabeth II. And now we have her son Charles.
Now you're just showing off.
Yeah, I know.
Question number, well, you'd probably expect that of someone with a doctorate in the nature of the crown and monarchy. Question number four was, what is the name of New Zealand's current Governor General?
I always despair at the answers that people give to this because, you know, you can get, people will put in the Prime Minister's name, they'll put in all sorts of things. At any rate, Dame Cindy Kiro is the current Governor General.
Question number five was, who was the first king or queen of New Zealand?
Well, now, see, this is a tricky question. See, I would say, I think you could make an argument that Queen Victoria was through the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi. But there are others who would say, well, now, hang on, that was because New Zealand was part of the British Empire at that point, and she was the queen of the British Empire. New Zealand wasn't really independent until what this passing of the Statute of Westminster in the 30s and in New Zealand the 40s. So you could make an argument then that the first truly independent king of New Zealand was King George VI. You might maybe argue George V. But the first monarch to actually have the title sovereign of New Zealand was Elizabeth II.
So for those who are keeping track, I'll give you any of those for answers. I had put down Victoria, but if you had any of those names which Dr. Palmer just used, they can be correct. Question number six was, who is third in line to the throne of New Zealand?
All right. Well, first in line is Prince William. Second in line is Prince George. So third in line is his sister, Princess Charlotte.
We've sort of already answered some of this in question seven. Name all of Prince William and Catherine's children.
So George, Charlotte, and their little brother, Louis.
Do you know their ages?
Oh, my goodness. No, I'm going to chalk that up to royalist. I'm afraid I don't know those.
Make sure you email me those if you do know or text. Question number eight. Is Charles the King of the United Kingdom or King of New Zealand?
Well, the correct answer is certainly both. He is the king of those countries. But when anybody says to you, oh, but he's the king of the UK, his primary focus is the UK, I would respond with, you know, he's also the king of Canada. Is there something you have against the UK?
Question number nine was, is Charles an admiral of the fleet, a field marshal, and an air marshal in New Zealand?
Yes, he is, and has been since before his mother passed away. So he is the only Admiral of the Fleet in New Zealand, the only Field Marshal of our Army, and the only Air Marshal in the Royal New Zealand Air Force.
And question 10 was, if Prince George becomes George VII, is that the highest number of any name?
Right. So, yeah, on the assumption that someday after King William V, that there will be a King George VII. The answer to that is no. As I've mentioned, there was an Edward VII in this list that we've had of monarchs in New Zealand. But there was also an Edward VIII, the one who abdicated. And just for good measure, there was also a Henry VIII, which I think most people would be aware of.
And look, this is a bonus question, one that I didn't share with listeners. It's one I'm going to throw at you right now. Since 1840, how many of New Zealand's heads of state have been women?
That's a good one. So of those seven monarchs that have been our heads of state, two were women, Victoria and Elizabeth. But what's really interesting about that is if we were to look at about 184 years since the signing of the Treaty of Waitangi, there has been a woman on the throne, Victoria and Elizabeth, for 130 of those years, which means that we have had a female head of state 70% of New Zealand's modern history. Outside of these Commonwealth realms, there is no country that has ever had that kind of female representation at the top level. I mean, there are a lot of countries today that have had no women in the top office ever.
I hope you guys have done well with the quiz. I'll be interested to know. You're welcome through, again, the email or text, or obviously through social media. Let us know how you did with those 10 questions. Otherwise, I just want to say, Sean, a big thank you for making the time for coming on Reality Check and here on Speak Free. Have really appreciated you talking us through all elements of the monarchy here in New Zealand.
Oh, well, I look forward to hearing what comments have come back and what we can cover in the next round.
Well, thanks very much.
Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.